I know what you're thinking. Oh no, it's Marty. We're going to be here for a long time. I just want you to know that in this, you can verify this by going to our website and looking at the sermons. Each one has a recorded number of minutes that those sermons lasted. And I want you to know the shortest sermon I ever preached was one entitled Redeeming the Time. It was probably 2-3 years ago, but perhaps an aspiration, the title of my lesson this morning is The Time is Shortened. And we'll see if that works or not. We're studying the book of 1 Corinthians in various ways. We're reading it together. The reading this past week was from chapter 6. This following week, I'm assuming, not too much of a deduction, will be chapter 7. And that's where the lesson will be from this morning. And you can see in the book of 1 Corinthians, a church that's troubled. And to some extent, we have to guess what those troubles were, both the difficulties Paul is correcting and the details behind them, as well as what they actually ask him in the letter they wrote, which he is answering beginning in this chapter 7. But it's a good exercise for us, not just because it will help us understand God's will, but because it will help us develop study skills. And so there are difficulties and interesting words, phrases, concepts, themes, and so on, which if we're interested in being better disciples of Christ, we'll use this study to develop our skills to do that. One exciting thing about focusing on a book for a long period of time, both zooming in on individual texts as well as zooming out on the whole picture, the outline of the whole book, the themes, is that you begin to see things of the bigger picture that we often don't do as we read through verse by verse. If you've been in many of the classes on a book like 1 Corinthians, often it's just a tedious study of one verse at a time. But when you get to the end and have the whole thing in your head, you begin to see more larger principles, perhaps, that you might not have seen in the individual verses. And I hope to show some of those this morning. I'll just make a quick review, really, of the issues that are discussed in 1 Corinthians. And by issues, I mean to include the things Paul addresses that they didn't ask about, and those that they did ask about. He begins really in the first four chapters discussing divisions among them. And these divisions were clearly an expression of their envy and pride within each other, but also an underlying respect for worldly power, wisdom, and this desire for respect or to be a fan of someone who was respected seems to be behind the divisions and this orienting themselves around specific teachers. And then they accepted sin in the group, a matter of fornication. In chapter 5, Paul says that needs to be corrected as a congregation. They seemed to be going to court against one another to win. I mean, why would you do that if you weren't trying to show you were right and the other guy was wrong and he owed you and so on? But they were using the courts of the worldly. And Paul says that's a failure when that happens. And then he also addresses sexual immorality, perhaps related to the very common and well accepted and not very often criticized activity of using the pagan temples as a worship, as a kind of an excuse or an opportunity for a fornication. It was definitely a cultural norm, which was difficult for them to put behind them. I'll pause briefly to say it's interesting they didn't ask him about any of these things. You know what I mean? They wrote in this letter and they didn't start by saying, what should we do about the divisions among us? Or what should we do about fornication? They didn't ask him about that. They started asking him some other more detailed questions, which we'll look at. And then skipping over 7, which we'll come back to, looking at chapters 8 forward, they ask him about, is it okay to eat meat sacrificed from idols? But that question begins with, because we know. We have knowledge. It's okay to do that. The women's covering may have been a question they asked. And, of course, that is a sign of authority and represents acceptance of particular roles, which are often not the leader roles. Maybe they are sometimes the follower roles. And perhaps that question has to do with that acceptance of my role in life. There was factious observance of the Lord's Supper, making it a common meal, perhaps. Those who had and those who had not were being separated, so some sense of pride or privilege suggested in the way they observed the Lord's Supper. And then the exercise of spiritual gifts, not whether, But which is best, right? And their perception was that something that showed exquisite skill, like being able to speak in a language, was perhaps superior. I hope you're sensing a kind of a common theme in the things that they ask about and the things that he addresses. What do these questions have in common? Well, I would say, first of all, the questions, that is, starting in chapter 7, they don't seem to be deep theological questions. Like, could you explain again the Trinity to us? Or what were those prophecies in Daniel really about? What were each of those things describing? Or what are the details of exactly how Jesus' blood atones for our sins every day in every person who's a believer? Those kinds of things. No, they were more like, now that I'm a Christian, what? And remember, these were young Christians. I think, to be fair, if the church was established in 52 AD and the letter maybe around 55, around Numbers, that's about 3 years. These are three-year-old Christians, if you want to think of it that way. And it's not surprising that they might have questions about practice, about what does this mean in my life, what changes do I need to make. But they are kind of new convert-type questions. But I think in every case, you could see a relationship in these questions to their earthly status. Do you see that? Did I exaggerate that too much as I went through? They're really asking, do I have to do this, or am I better if I do this? Even chapter 7 maybe begins by saying, you know what, maybe to be a super Christian, I should be celibate, even though I'm married, for example. Maybe that's the reason behind it. But they all seem to do with really a tie to the world, somehow or another, using my status in the world or making it some kind of a barrier or some kind of a competition in which I can look better than somebody else. Maybe even using the church and my status within the church that way. So I think they have to do, often these questions have to do with whether I'm respected, whether I'm superior to someone else, how do I stand in competition, and do I look wise and powerful, maybe to start with what's in the beginning of the book. I don't know. I just suggest that. In the process of answering these questions, it's interesting, though, that Paul has some excursions. And I use that term, I should go back and cover chapter 7. This is the context of chapter 7. I'm guessing he asked them questions. If you think you know the exact questions they ask, I think you're fooling yourself. But he does address some topics. One is, what are the sexual requirements in marriage? Again, these fall in the same category as the questions, as the characteristics we saw earlier. What do I do now that I'm a Christian? Am I better off if I don't have sexual relationships? 1-7, widowers, which is perhaps the others, and then the widows in 8-9, what should they do? What if you're married? And then, of course, it's related to divorce. Can I divorce? If I am divorced, can I remarry? Those are both are commandments from the Lord, which he imports, I think, from the writings of Mark and Matthew and others. What if I'm married to a pagan? And I put in parenthesis, not that it's in the text, and I don't like it. I'd like to get out of it. Aren't I not being a bad Christian if I'm, you know, still living with in a marriage relationship with this unbeliever? 12-16. And then some teaching for those that are not yet married, or those, including widows, perhaps, that might be married. And so what should you do? If you want to get married, is it hard? Is it easy? So I'm not covering any of these today. I'm going to leave that for the teachers in these various classes that you're in to talk about the details of that. I want to look at something else. And that is the way Paul often, in the process of answering these questions, steps back, or you might think he is changing the subject and going off on, I'm going to call that an excursion. You know what an excursion is? If you're on a boat cruise and you're going somewhere, you pull into a port and you go off somewhere else, which is kind of like not in the same direction, and then you come back. Is that what's happening here? There's some excursions in the text which at first don't appear to relate to the questions Paul is answering. For example, in the process of addressing divisions in chapters 1-3, he gets off on this foolishness of God, wisdom of men, weakness of God, weakness of man, power of God, and all that. What does it have to do with divisions? What does it have to do with divisions? How does the message get from God's mind to our mind? The Spirit searches the mind of God. What does it have to do with divisions? Is it really on the same topic? What's the role of God's workers in His house and in His field? Watering, planting. What does that have to do with divisions? How is that fixing the problem that he begins to address? Okay, I'll leave that as an exercise to the reader, but think about it. With regard to immoral behavior and lawsuits and fornication in chapters 5 and 6, He gets off into a discussion of leaven and Passover, right, from the Old Testament. Interesting that these new converts knew enough about the Old Testament law at 3 years that they could understand Passover and leaven and all that. What about our relationship to the world? Did you know we'll judge the angels? I don't know. How does that fit in? And our future glory in the kingdom. Oh, non-relationship to the world. Yes, we live among the world, but not of the world. And then our participation in the body of Christ. Actually, I should say membership, for once actually getting the metaphors correctly together. Our membership in the body of Christ. Now, I hope you're sitting there thinking, well, I know how they're related. But the point is that Paul zooms out and says, no, there are larger principles. There are bigger truth, elements of truth here that apply to this answer I'm giving you. Now I'll give you the answer, right? And I'll give you even my opinions on occasions. And I'll tell you what I am saying and what I'm not saying on occasion. Very specific things. But I want you to know there's larger truth here. And so I really think my thesis in a sense for the lesson is that when we look at these, quote, excursions, I think they're not. And they may actually be where the main truth lies that we can apply if we're not in these specific situations. We're not in the middle, I hope, of a church that has a bunch of divisions or that there's a bunch of immorality among us that we're taught. But there's truth still in what Paul says that we can apply. We're not in Corinth. There are cultural uniquenesses in Corinth that may or may not apply to us. We'll talk about the present distress this morning. Does it make these applicable? What makes it applicable are these larger principles, which look like an excursion, but really, when we look closer, they're not. So I want to talk about, from chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, two excursions, if you will. Remember that Paul is talking about marriage. I just showed you that. Unmarried, married, people who are divorced, widows, whether you should have sexual relationships in a marriage. But notice that suddenly, in verse 17, the topic shifts, and I put in yellow, it's hard to see, a couple of words, circumcised and slaves. You see those in the text? Where did that come from? Is there anything in the question about slaves and circumcision and uncircumcision? Paul seems to be going off in a different direction here, not really directly related to the specific questions. And I'm going to read this with you. In fact, I should just read it out of here. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk, so ordain in all the churches. This is common advice to all the churches, not just perhaps Corinth, where there may have been a specific distress of some kind. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But keeping the commandment of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. Boy, tough, huh? But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. So you see, that's the marketplace, the redemption. By being bought on you might think of it as a slave market. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. And then he goes back to apparently answering questions. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment, but I give this judgment and so on. I will note that in verse 26, he mentions that his advice is somehow related to a present distress. This is New King James I'm reading from and will mostly use this morning. But now down to verse 29, again, it seems like he goes off. Is that right? I think that's the wrong reference at the top. It's verses 29 through 32. But this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on, even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy as though they did not possess. Those who use this world as not misusing it, for the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be without care. We'll talk about some of the meanings of those things. Do you notice he's bringing up now new topics? Where did buying and selling come from? Is that in the question that they ask him? What about weeping and rejoicing? Is that relevant to the text? What about using the world, whatever that means? You see, he's zooming out. He's expanding this answer to discuss other principles. And Brethren, I think that's where maybe we can find the deepest application, because he's zooming out to say, this is the way the world works. What does he mean, though? We have to understand that. So that's all I want to talk about this morning, are these two excursions, and not the specific answers to the imagined questions that we come up with. I think there's a foundation principle in both of these excursions, and it's simple as this. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Well, notice some of these things. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But keeping the commandments of God is. And you know italics. I hope you're learning in our study how to study. Italics means that the translators put that in to help us understand it. I would say the American Standard doesn't put it in, but it just says, but keeping the commandments of God. It's almost like saying there's something that's nothing. I'm sorry, that doesn't sound right, does it? Circumcision is nothing, but you know what, you want to know what something is? If this is nothing, the something is keeping God's commandments. I think that's what he's saying. Were you called a slave? Do not be concerned about it. Boy, that hurts us. We can hardly stand it that somebody that looks like me put somebody that looks like somebody else under slavery in the past. We can hardly deal with that and think about it straight, can we? Without getting emotionally charged up. Paul says, if you called Raul a slave, don't get over it. He says, don't be concerned about it. That's kind of weird. And I should tell you that I think what he says about circumcision may be more striking given Paul's background than that, right? Pharisee of Pharisee, the tribe of Benjamin, all that. And he says, you know what, it doesn't even matter whether you're circumcised or not. Do you understand how radical that is in Paul's thinking? And in the Jew-Gentile controversy that relates all the way back to the chosen people of God in the Old Testament? And he's saying, that doesn't matter. Don't be concerned about it. That's hard to me to think about that. I'm not saying it's easy. But I'm telling you, that's what the underlying principle seems to be. And perhaps the reason is the form of this world is passing away. So there's something temporary about all of this. It doesn't really matter because it's about to be done away with. It's about to change. All the rules are going to change in this. And I think he ends and maybe begins the next section with this maybe connective sentence, which is, I want you to be without care. We'll look more particularly at that word at the end if I have time. But I think a translation that's valid, in fact, it's all even found in the New Testament, is I just want you to be secure people. I don't want you to be worrying and fretting and nervous and anxious about all these things that don't matter. You see that? That's what he's saying, I think. What time is it? How am I doing in making my short sermon, I guess I should ask? I'd like to think about these excursions maybe by looking at three questions or three principles that have to do with what time it is. And they all have reference to time in some way or another. And we'll go through each one and look at the terms specifically. And I hope that will illuminate some of the thoughts that Paul is giving in this, quote, excursion. The present distress is found in verse 26. And it's almost as if he's saying, you know, this distress is coloring my advice that I'm about to give you. I'm not going to go into the advice, but I'm going to say, what is this present distress? Looking at the words particularly, present, which in the translation I read, and probably the one you have, most of them at least, have present as an adjective, right? So the distress is the noun, and present describes it or modifies the noun. Y'all know grammar, at least adjectives modify or describe nouns. But really, it's not that. It's a verb that's a participle, which means it's acting as an adjective. Describing a noun. And the fact that it's a participle means that it has a tense. It has a present perfect tense. And so I can use a phrase like, I have done it. And it's still done, by the way. So in the present, it's a completed action. And so this this present means this distress, which not is coming upon us, but it's more like has come upon us. In fact, that's actually what the American Standard says correctly. The distress that is upon us. You see that? It's using the verb, which is coming upon us, turning it into a participle or adjective. So it's suggesting that it's really here. It's been completed. It's around us. We know what it is. Interesting that it's not really discussed anywhere else in the book, that at least in terms of some special thing. And then the distress word itself is really from a couple of Greek words, which means to bend, or it's up, backward, up, bend, but bend up. And I imagine a wrestling hold where you get somebody in in that hold and you twist them and they you know, and you got them kind of where they can't move and they're bent and it's not comfortable and that's where they are. But that's the idea. It's a necessity of distress or constraint. So a present distress. Now, what could this be? I think one possible meaning is that it's just this huge persecution which will shortly come upon the Christians there. That doesn't quite match the tense. But it could be related to the persecution by Nero, which is about 10 years off. We know that now, looking backward. 10 years off, around AD 65, and you probably remember blaming the Christians and burning them on stakes and feeding them to animals and all that. That began about 10 years later and continued through other emperors following that. And maybe that's related to Daniel 7 prophecy about that fourth ugly, terrible beast that he couldn't hardly describe that had the horns, and one of them shouted insults and made war against the saints. Maybe that's what it is. That's a possibility. Second possibility is it's a local temporary difficulty in Corinth. Verse 17 suggests that what he's saying to them in this chapter is, you know, applicable to all the churches. So I would tend not to make it too localized. But some people think it was a specific persecution. We read about that in Acts 18, how that began when the church began. It could be that it was a famine. Some people have proposed that. Some have proposed it was a pandemic. Now, that could never happen. But, you know, some local difficulty that makes their life or their choices, their faithfulness as Christians a challenge. And another possibility is this general conflicts that all Christians should expect as prophesied in this age. And Paul says in another place, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace but a sword. And so the present could actually mean it's come upon us in this Christian age. It's here, past perfect tense. And this, it's a difficulty, and it maybe applies to all of us. Here's my main point in all that, and that is none of these interpretations really limit the possibility that we could have distresses right now. We could be under distress right this minute, or shortly, if you think it's not one of the more severe possibilities. But it's something that's in place in terms of time. What time is it? Present distress. That's one answer. Not only that, in verse 29, he says it's a shortened time. And the first thought, and again, maybe the lesson will be a shortened time, but is that we're making our clocks run faster. Or maybe the alarm clock is set and it's about to go off. Maybe it's about to go off. And so the word time, and you may remember this from our, if you're in our class on first or second Timothy, really more, there's two words for time, chronos, calendar time, tick of the clock, or there is kairos, which is a season or a period, an opportunity. As Paul also uses in 2 Timothy, and he says, perilous times will come. Later in the next verse, the next chapter, he says, preach the word in season and out of season. That's oikairos and akairos, when it's good seasons and not seasons, right? But the idea is it's an opportunity, it's occasion. It's not really a number of years or a number of minutes. It's a period. I don't know other words to use for that. Can you help me with that? It's not a period of time measured by a clock, for example. And he says it's shortened. Now, that word for shortened really is the same word that you would use when you had a corpse and you wrapped it up real tight. You compressed it, maybe to keep the arms and legs from falling off as the body decayed. That's kind of gross to think about, but that's the idea. It's being compressed or shortened in the sense that it's wrapped up. It's interesting that Jesus said in Matthew 24:22 about, I think, the destruction of Jerusalem. And he says, unless the time was shortened, no flesh would be saved. This is an act of mercy God is describing to us. The time is short, not to put us in panic, but to give us comfort, to help us understand, to help us be saved, because whatever this distress is, it can be shortened, and we understand how short the time will be, so it's easier to make it through. Is that, can you see that? So I don't think Paul is saying judgment is coming tomorrow, right? It's not a prediction of the judgment day, because as we know, now 2 millennia later, that hasn't happened yet. But I think what he's saying is, like often in our lives, something happens, and it makes the time either drag, or it makes the time just fly by. You know what I mean? Just a short time. Our perception is different. The clock isn't running any faster on the wall. It isn't that Jesus will come any minute, although we are told to act as if he might. I'm not putting that point aside. But I think he's saying in this age we have a different perception of how God has wrapped up, constrained this time to make it short. To make it short for us. To deal with the things we have to deal with. And so, as a result of that, we have a changed perception of things. And he goes through a list of five things. As a result of that, we have a changed perception of marriage. After all, did you know that marriage is temporary? We often teach that it's permanent, but no, it ends at the end of time. There'll be no marrying or giving in marriage at the end of time. There's no sorrow, or if you sorrow, it will be like you don't have that sorrow. Or if you're happy or rejoicing, it's like you don't have that. It's almost like bad news and good news does not affect us with the same depth. In fact, some things that might seem really, really, really sad to people, like the loss of a loved one, don't seem that sad. In fact, there's a kind of rejoicing that would go with it. You see how I'm illustrating that? Our whole view of things is different, you see. The world isn't changed, but we have, and our perception of it is different. We see this in shortened time, because it's almost over. That's the way we see the world. You buy something and you own it, you know you're not going to keep it very long. I think Jesus told that, told the story of the rich fool, and he told him when he's going to die. He said, "And then whose will these things be?" It won't be yours. You're not going to own them very long because the time is short. And he says, using the world. And I would just say that's all the things every day that give us comfort, that we can plan around, that we can challenge ourselves with, that we can claim to have accomplished something. And he says, that's not misusing it. That's the New King James, but I think the idea is, not using it to the full. American Standard has that concept behind it. And I think that makes the most sense and seems to fit the language the best. There, it fits the other four for sure. There's just a limit to what we really can use the world for and how much it means to us when we do. And so our perception is really changed. So really, the message here of this second reference to time is that Christians see things completely differently and opposite. Paul tells the Thessalonians that when someone dies, that you sorrow not, even as the rest. And so he says Christians have a completely different opposite view because he says those who experience this thing, though it's as though, and so he makes that comparison. That goes all the way through in that parallelism for those five things. So what time is it? It's a constrained time. It's a shortened time in which Paul is answering these practical questions. Okay, so this animation is kind of odd. And then finally, what time is it? And that is, the form is passing away. Form is a word that describes the order of things, how they work, the mechanics, the fashion, the external condition of them. It's really, I'm going to call it how the world works, the rules that we live by. And really, this phrase is at the end of that those five things. Is Paul saying, act like you don't have a wife, even if you have one? If somebody's sad, you just laugh at them. If somebody's laughing, you get mourny and weepy about that. Is that what he's saying? Well, no, he's been very clear, even in this very chapter, about responsibilities of men and women to each other who are married. So he's not saying ignore the marriage relationship. Ephesians 5:25 is that. Romans 12, rejoice with those that rejoice, weep with those that weep. So it's not a contradiction of those others' instructions. But it's the idea that we are at the beginning of the end. There's a transition occurring to a new order. The form, the order, the rules about this world are passing away. These things should move us, these pictures, about a time that's compressed and shortened as a mercy, about a form and order that's going to be totally redone, that will make the things that we think are so important and critical in our lives, they don't matter. Did I start by saying that? I hope I did. If they're nothing, it doesn't make any difference. Marriage is not permanent. Things that make us happy and sad now will pass away. You can think of a lot of illustrations, but suppose you knew that you had a terminal disease, you're going to die at the end of the week, and you won the lottery, and the check's going to come in on Thursday. How much celebration would you have over that? You see the point? Rules have changed. And when they change, boy, our perceptions change with them. That's the idea. Romans 8 expresses it this way, and I didn't put the whole text, but you ought to go back a couple of verses before and maybe a couple of verses after. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. The time is short. The world is passing away. The fashion of this world is passing away. We know the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also have the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of the body. I'm going to make a couple of points. I think you can see the obvious one is things are changing and we're looking forward to that change. That's one thing. The other is we have the beginning of the change already. Do you notice that? We have a deposit, a first fruits kind of a thing. We are already seeing what the messianic prophecies were saying would happen when the kingdom came. And we're redeemed and we have these great blessings, but they're not all that they will be until the world is actually changed. You see that? You might even think of it this way. The prophets from the Old Testament looked forward to that day when the Messiah would come. And maybe from their viewpoint, from so far away, it looked like everything would be solved. No, all evil taken away. God's people reign unchallenged, right? They're not threatened at all. Now, other prophets clarify that. But as you come from the old to the new, you begin to see, oh, wait, there's a period here that we're in now, the shortened time. But we have the Messiah. We have the promises. And yet we still wait for the final consummation. So that's why I say it's the beginning of the end, so to speak, that we're talking about here. In this idea of the passing form, the world's form. And I want to mention one other verse, and I will say this lightly because I think you could take this phrase. It's right after this. It comes right in verse 32. I hope you're looking at your text. He ends with a sentence, which is, "But I want you to be without care." Now, the word care appears again in the next verses when he talks about those that are married or careful or anxious for their mates and all that. And so maybe it is connected with the next section. Maybe it's connected to both what came before and what came after. But I want you to look at this word care for a second. It's amerimnos, Greek word. And as you probably know, means not. Like apathetic means without feeling, right? Or atheo means atheist, not without God. So it's the opposite of something. And it's the opposite of being distracted or being anxious or nervous or having a care. And actually it's translated secure in Matthew 28, verse 14. If this come to the governor's ears, you remember this is the Jewish leaders telling these soldiers, hey, I know the body got lost here, but you know, here's the story we want you to tell. And if it comes to the governor's ear, we'll appease him and make you secure. Secure is the word. Don't be nervous. Don't worry about it. We got it. Take care of it. I wonder if maybe Paul is, and of course the word itself without the negative is the deep concern. I wonder if Paul is kind of just saying at the end of this whole thing about the shortened time and the world, the form of the world is passing away. He's just saying, I just don't want you to be anxious. I just don't want you to be worrying about this stuff. It doesn't matter. It can be a concern in our lives. It's not important. And he's talking about pretty deep things related to our identity, our race, didn't he? Our marital status, didn't he? Whether we're a slave or not. Boy, hard things. Hard things. What's he saying? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What are some applications? We're not to be preoccupied with earthly circumstances. I hope you got that. I don't need to explain that. But I'll just tell you, we get so anxious about the job I wanted, the raise I should have gotten, or the bargain that I missed, or the guy that cheated me, or even more difficult things about family and losses and inequities and unfairness in the way I'm treated and those kind of things. We're just not to be preoccupied with that. That is hard in our world because that's the basis of almost every news story there is how is this affecting you? If this person gets elected or this policy doesn't happen or this disease isn't stopped or something like that. Oh, how can we deal with that? And don't you see that kind of underlies a lot of these questions? Well, is it okay to have sexual relationships with my wife? Well, what if she's a pagan? You know, these are earthly circumstances. And I'm not saying they're easy, but I am saying they don't matter. And that would help us, I think, deal with them if we could see that. Our well-being, how I am doing as a person, it doesn't depend on whether I'm in good or bad circumstances. And I tried to give examples of both sides of this coin. My marriage is everything to me, right? My children, my family. If you have your health, you have everything. You ever heard that? Don't say that. It isn't. No matter how great your marriage is or how wonderful your kids are and all that. And God's given us the capacity to enjoy all those things. But that in us, and our well-being isn't tied up in how they're doing or how they're being, how we're being treated by them. Turn it around. My marriage is unbearable. My children, deep trouble, causing me all kind of grief. My family is a mess. My health is terrible. Same thing, just the other side of the coin. And we can't envy others who have some of these things, who have status in life. They have a title. Maybe they're an elder or a deacon in the church, of all things, or a paid preacher or something. I don't have that. They have romance. I don't. They have the respect of the world. I don't. They have spouses. I don't. They have children. I wish I had children. They're beautiful. They have things I wish I had. Their skin color is the one I wish I had. Right? They have honor. They have power, and so on and so on. Is this a fair application? I believe it's really right out of the text. He talks about race. He talks about the status of being a slave. He talks about things that make you happy if they're good and sad if they're not. At the same time, the other side of this same coin is you don't feel superior because you've got those things. Please. Because you have status or skills or respect or spouses or children or youth or beauty or possessions or skin color of a certain kind, honor or power. That's not something to be proud of either. You're not superior for that. It doesn't matter. Did I mention that earlier? And also then, kind of further, we can easily accept the loss of these things. And probably this plays into the idea of the present distress, perhaps. Are you prepared to lose your job suddenly without any backup plan? Are you prepared to lose a relationship for whatever reason? Death? Some type of a betrayal? Are you prepared for that? And can you easily accept it in the sense that the world is short and it doesn't matter? And those who mourn they don't mourn anymore. It doesn't make us that sad. Are we prepared to lose relationships, wealth, possessions? And it could be that we lose them because we're just in a world that's fallen, or it could be we lose them for the kingdom's sake. And then Shirley, y'all know Shirley, who shows up on occasion. She shows up and says something like, "Surely God would not expect me to do this, or surely God doesn't require me to give this thing up." You understand what I mean? I think it applies. And Paul, in these commands, may be telling them some things that are quite difficult, staying with your pagan wife and not divorcing and not depriving one another, and things that we might find difficult or even distasteful. And Shirley shows up and says, "But God would..." No, it's okay because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And all of the above circumstances must not interfere with our service to God. It's striking that in the middle of all this, Paul says, keeping the commandments of the Lord is what mattered, is the interpolated. That's the reality. Other stuff is nothing. If you want to know what the something is, it's keeping the Lord's commandments. That's it. That's the substance. Oh, I guess that's the end. The time is really short now. But if that's the commandment of the Lord, that's something, we ask you to think about that this morning. Are you in the body of Christ, members of His body, where this new reality sets in and you begin to see the world in entirely different ways? Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5, "Behold, all things have become new." He didn't mean that the world was all different, that God somehow or another changed all the circumstances in your life, so now it's all going to be different. No, it's all the same, actually. What's different is our perception of it. And that's what he's saying here. And those are the principles, I think, that inform, these are the abstract excursions, but they inform the specific details of all that Paul is saying, I think, throughout the entire book. I hope that's been helpful. If you need to do something in a public way, responding to God's call that he gave, not in the wisdom of the world, not in the words that are flashy and persuasive that the world will use, but rather in the crucified Christ. Two contradictory terms, but they're God's wisdom. We'd encourage you to take advantage of that and come while we stand and sing.
Heavenly Father,